From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. This is, of course, when we get you updated on the news that made headlines this last week around our region. And today, our panel includes Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Sydney Kidd, reporter with BoiseDev.com, Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, and Nate Eaton, news director at EastIdahoNews.com. Hi, everybody. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
So I would love to start our conversation about the Democratic National Convention. It wrapped up last night after 4 days, a lot of buzz around it. But Melissa, folks may not know that we had actual delegates from the state of Idaho there on the convention floor. So tell us about who was there and why.
Every state had delegates there. Some delegations are larger than others based on population and also, you know, how many Democratic voters they have. Idaho mm-hmm. had a small delegation during the roll call on Tuesday. Those votes were announced by Idaho Democratic Party Chairwoman Laura Necochea. She's also an outgoing state representative. But, it was an exciting national conversation. I don't have much to add about that. But what I do want to say is I've seen some chatter about, like, you know, why bother with the Electoral College? Mm-hmm. Why bother participating in this election? Or it doesn't matter quite as much. But I just want to remind people how many things are on the ballot down ticket and how many races in recent years have been decided by just a handful of votes in big legislative districts, too. We also have a highly contested initiative on the ballot. And so, this is my plug that even if, you know, you feel disenfranchised in a deep red state as a blue voter, still get out there and vote. And, you know, you have until October 25th to request an absentee ballot. And you can still register at the polls in Idaho. And I don't think it's too early to start having that conversation about voter participation.
You know, it's funny, Melissa, that you mentioned this because I was literally on a panel just 2 days ago, and it was talking about the Electoral College and how does that impact the state of Idaho, right? And one of the things we talked about is exactly what you said, because someone in the audience raised their hand and basically is a disenfranchised voter, doesn't see the point of voting, because when you're in a state like Idaho, if you don't vote Republican, then you know what happens to your vote? Is there a reason? So again. What's the point? And we talked about exactly what you said, which is you have to remember that every legislative seat is up, right? And we have an open primary initiative.
And also county seats too.
Right.
That's huge.
Yes. Right. And so it's kind of like there are things on the ballot that will impact your everyday life that have nothing to do with a presidential election. And so it's, I think sometimes, you know, having people kind of remember that, right? So yeah, my plug too, get out there and vote. We are lucky enough to be able to vote in this country. So get out there and vote.
And people are already door knocking for these legislative seats, for these county seats, especially in purple districts, and they do exist in Idaho. Glad we're on the same page, Gemma, get out and vote.
Yeah, there you go. Get out and vote. Okay. So cyber attacks, this is something that it really made national news when it hit healthcare systems all around the country this past year. But Nate, you're now learning of a cyber attack that impacted the Shoshone-Bannock tribe recently. So what do you know about this?
Well, we know a little bit that it happened last weekend. We don't know exactly what caused it. A lot of times these are caused by somebody maybe clicking on a link on a spam type of email or allowing access to, you know, somebody from outside the network to access the internal documents or whatever. But it happened last weekend. The tribes notified people on Monday, and then some meetings were held, but it has basically crippled operations at the Shoshone-Bannock tribes. They've had to send home employees this week on Monday, and then again yesterday and today, in order to allow their cybersecurity team to work on the computers and the technology equipment that they have. They, you know, when these things happen, happen. A lot of times they don't release a ton of information because you're obviously dealing with nefarious people and organizations or other government agencies. Who knows who you're dealing with as far as who's hacked in? So they're not releasing a lot of information. But in fact, when we got the information from the tribes, the public relations person we normally work with, she had to send it from her personal email because she can't get into her work email. So they're hoping to have everything up and running back to normal next week, but it is becoming an issue that, as you mentioned, the healthcare systems, but government systems, the city of Blackfoot years ago had the same issue. It seems that government agencies and companies, businesses, everybody really could maybe fall victim to this.
So Nate, what about the Shoshone-Bannock Casino itself? Was there any information on, were people who were, at the casino, was any of their information hacked? Because I'm just thinking about how many people go through there, right? And if they even know or if can even talk about that at all.
That's a great question. They haven't addressed the casino operation, but that would be a lot of data, especially, bank account information that are tied to the players' cards that the people use there. Right now, they're saying the main effect has been the actual tribes, like their computer systems, their company resources or tribal resources, I should say. That's what they've addressed now. And to be honest, they may not know at this point who all has been affected. It may take weeks or months before the people that have been affected get one of those emails or letters in the mail that says, "Hey, you've been the victim of a cybersecurity attack. Sign up for credit monitoring." All the information they've released so far has that it's been related to the actual tribal network. No word on though the casino, how that's affected, but that's a question we have asked.
And the U.S. attorney, I'm assuming is already on this, right, Nate?
Right. They're involved in it because it is the FBI's involved in it, the Homeland Security Department, they're involved in it. They say that they're working to identify the source and the scope of the incident, along with other vulnerabilities. It's crazy that, like I said, a lot of these things can just be one person that happens to click on the wrong thing in an email, and then it can take down an entire government agency. And of course, this happened with into casinos. Speaking of casinos in Las Vegas, I believe earlier
Oh,
this
that's
year,
right.
Caesars Palace and MGM, it was shut down because of an email hack. So always check those emails.
Right. Kevin, Idaho hasn't updated its high school graduation requirements in more than a decade, but they are one step closer to updating them. So what possible changes to these requirements could we see?
I think probably the biggest change would be a new requirement in digital citizenship, which kind of ties into what Nate was just talking about. What this course would do, and it's obviously still very much in the in progress, would be a class that would give high school students some grounding in algorithms and AI. Also, talk about internet safety and digital citizenship. It's way down the road, but it's not that far down the road. If this were to come to pass, if the legislature were to sign on to this next winter, this class in digital literacy would go into effect in 2028. So this year's ninth graders would have to take this at some point in high school if this were to pass. It will be interesting to see kind of how this goes from here. The legislature, like I said, will have the final word on this graduation change, if it were to occur, were to occur. There's a trade-off. To add this class in digital literacy, the state would get rid of a required high school credit in communications. So I suspect you'll see some debate about the relative merits of a digital literacy class as opposed to a communications class. And the whole reason you're going to have that kind of a conversation is State Superintendent Debbie Critchfield went into this wanting to not change the basic numbers. You need 46 high school credits to graduate, 29 are required, 17 are electives. They didn't want to change those numbers. So if you want to add a requirement, you had to get rid of a requirement. So it's a complicated process. And I guess that's part of why the state hasn't really changed its graduation requirements in a decade. It's a tough trade-off.
So Kevin, I have a question, and I don't know if you can answer this or not, but I have a high school student, and The thing that surprised me the most when he started his freshman year 2 years ago was learning that what we require in high school for Idaho to graduate high school in Idaho, if your child is planning on going out of state to college, we don't have enough requirements. For example, like we only require one semester of like of an art class, right, as an elective. A lot of out-of-state colleges, and I'm talking like in Washington and Oregon, where a lot of kids would go, require a year. We don't have the same requirement for foreign language. And so I didn't know this as a parent going into this. And I think it takes a lot of people by surprise. So, I mean, when we're talking about those graduation requirements, I mean, is there any conversation about that at all?
I think that's probably part of why there's this emphasis on trying to keep the electives as open as possible to give a student who's trying to go to college in another state a chance to squeeze in more classes in art or in a foreign language. Yeah. And, you know, 46 is the minimum. I mean, you know, they're, you know, high school kids who take classes in 0 hour, or they take classes in the summer, or they, you know, they figure out a way to work in some dual credit classes along the way. So, you know, I think the bottom line of trying to add a high school graduation requirement is, you know, again, you're adding something not just to the students. You're not just putting something on the students' plate, but you're also putting something on the school's plate. They're going to figure out how to add this class and make sure that it's available to students across the board, because they're all going to need it to graduate. So, you know, again, I think there's a reason why this is complicated. There's a reason why we don't do this very often, and probably a really good reason why, if this change happens, it doesn't go into effect right away, and it really doesn't affect any kid before ninth grade.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the clarification on that. And really, I think the complication and how involved graduation requirements are and even changing them, because I think sometimes as parents, you know, you're like, well, okay, why don't we have this or why don't we have that? But just having a better understanding definitely helps. Sydney, a lot of people drive on Eagle Road. In fact, by a little bit of research that I've done, it is one of the busiest roadways in the state of Idaho. And you've just reported that parts of Eagle Road are going to close down, which we've seen before, but you're talking upwards of a year.
Yeah. So, like you said, Eagle Road is a major roadway in the valley. And then also another thing that we have been seeing happening over the past several years is there's been a lot of development and like subdivision growth in the like South Meridian, Southwest Boise, unincorporated Ada County area that basically stretches from like Cole Road to Meridian Road, and then like everything from Victory Road up. So it's a big area that's experienced a huge population increase in the past several years. And the roads are just hanging on. And so ACHD is trying to increase road capacity. And one of these projects will require shutting down Eagle Road from Lake Hazel Road to Amity Road. And like you said, it'll be shut down for probably a little over a year. Yeah, this project was actually supposed to start in the winter of this year, about February-ish. But they ran into some problems with an electrical subcontractor on the project not being properly licensed. And so the project got delayed. And now it should start mid-September.
Okay, so a whole year, though, on that portion of Eagle Road. So, Kevin, Attorney General Raul Labrador is now saying that the state cannot be sued over our new library law that went into effect July 1. So before we get into his argument on this, can you just refresh our memories on what this new law is and what it does?
Oh, yeah, we've written volumes and volumes about this library law. What this basically does is it tries to restrict access to harmful materials, what the law defines as materials that would be harmful to minors. And the crux of the law, a big piece of the law, and this gets into this legal battle, is what's called the private cause of action. And that's kind of a fancy legalese term for you can sue, you can seek financial damages if you feel like you've been wronged by this law. I feel like I'm, talking like I'm, one of those lawyers you see in a late night ad. If you feel like you were wronged by this, you can seek money. And that's basically what this law says, is if you're a parent and you feel like your kid was received, had access to material that they shouldn't have access to, you can seek financial damages from that library. Could be a school library, could be a public library. So that enforcement mechanism is really important, because now you have the Attorney General's office saying, we the state cannot be sued over this law because we the state do not enforce it. Citizens enforce it through this private cause of action. This sounds like a really maybe, out there legal argument, but there's actually some precedent to this. This came up in Texas with regard to an abortion law, and it was upheld in court. So Attorney General Labrador's office is saying that is precedent that applies to this Idaho lawsuit. The Idaho lawsuit basically is private schools and private libraries have sued, saying that this is an encroachment upon their operations as private entities, because it does apply to private schools and privately run libraries in addition to public libraries and public school libraries. So anyway, Ryan Soupy had the story about this latest legal maneuvering, and we're going to be following this in the months to come. It's going to be a long and gnarly legal battle.
Okay, so if I'm understanding this correctly, and I know, Melissa, you've been following this too, so either Kevin or Melissa weigh in on this, is that the Attorney General is saying, no, you can't sue us. So even you private schools, private libraries, you, even though you've put this lawsuit up, you can't sue us because we don't enforce it. Am I understanding this correctly?
Yeah, I mean, that's the crux of it. I mean,
Okay.
the state is saying that they are not, subject to enforcing this law because, it's not their law to enforce.
And whether the court agrees is a question that, obviously we'll wait and see. But Kevin had mentioned that in Texas, this law, as it relates to their abortion ban, the court upheld that one. Idaho's court also upheld the same civil enforcement mechanism in one of Idaho's abortion statutes that allows family members to sue physicians or hospitals or medical providers who perform abortions. So there is also a legal precedent here for the court saying, yes, this is something, and that's not, there are other parts of this law and this lawsuit that are certainly different than Idaho's abortion law and the Texas abortion law. But a similar civil enforcement mechanism or private cause of action, however you want to refer to it, has been in front of Idaho's courts.
And we're
So,
seeing more and more pieces of legislation too, Gemma, and I think that's worth noting. I mean, this is a concept that we've seen applied to several other kind of bills, and the idea of a private cause of action is itself controversial. I mean, there are, folks in the legislature who have been critical of it. Governor Little, last year, when he vetoed a library bill, which wasn't all that different from the one that he signed into law this year, when he vetoed the bill last year, he was concerned about the private cause of action. He said it created a bounty system. So, this is definitely an emerging legal argument and an emerging issue that we're seeing, crop up in legislation over and over at the State House.
When we
Well, the
started
part.
covering this civil enforcement mechanism last year when it was proposed, we had I, it was one of my favorite panel discussions that we had that season on Idaho Report. It's about talking how this is a novel legal mechanism, how it affects government entities' ability to get insurance. It, potentially affects a library's ability to get insurance if they say, "Hey, we don't want to insure somebody who might constantly get sued over what's on their shelves." And it's I don't know that we can call it a novel legal approach anymore. It is becoming a lot more common and a lot more accepted.
So also part of this that I think I'm not fully understanding, and maybe listeners aren't either, private school libraries put into this bill? I mean, how can the state pass a bill like that, a law like that, when there is supposed to be a separation when it comes to private versus public?
Well, and I think that's the big part of the lawsuit that came from the private schools and the private libraries. They're saying this is an infringement upon their operations as private entities. It's an infringement upon parents who choose to send their kids to a private school. You know, that's going to be a really interesting argument as well, because, you know, you're right. I mean, it's one thing for the legislature and the governor to, you know, impose regulations upon public entities, you know, taxpayer funded public entities. But when you head into now what is a, what are private entities, that's interesting. And it certainly raises a lot of questions in a lot of different areas about the state's role in, you know, expecting private entities to comply with state law.
Right. I really do find that part very interesting. I appreciate all of that information on this, though, because you're right. It's going to be a long, drawn-out process. Nate, your organization, eastidahonews.com, is working with the Idaho National Laboratory to commemorate 75 years of the INL. I have been on that property numerous times back in the day when I was a little baby reporter in Idaho Falls. But can you tell us a little bit about this collaboration?
Yeah, I think every reporter that works in Eastern Idaho goes out there at least one time or another.
And exactly. To be honest,
most of us don't understand a quarter or a tenth of what happens out there.
And oh, you're giving us more credit than that, Nate, if you think we all understand a tenth of it.
And actually, a lot of reporters end up leaving news and going to work out there, at least in Eastern Idaho. But because so much is happening out there that we really don't know about, that we as the public don't know about, we have collaborated with them for their 75th anniversary to do 14 in-depth stories this year. And so we're going out there and spending a day or two or three days sometimes to go in-depth on different topics, everything from things that happened in the past, to space batteries, to the history of the INL, to current things happening, to the future. And then we're producing video pieces and written pieces to hopefully help all of us understand a bit what's happening. It's one of Eastern Idaho's largest employer, or the largest employer, and it's growing. And so that's kind of what we've been doing for the past several months. And I have to be honest with you, there's been some fascinating discoveries in my own personal opinion as far as what I've learned.
Well, I have to say, Nate, I mean, you know, when I covered the INL, I mean, this was a long time ago, right out of college. I didn't know really anything about the INL. And I think that once you start learning more about it, you're right. Not only is it the largest employer in Eastern Idaho, but I mean, really its significance nationally, right? So with that said, you said you're doing these, you know, going out there 14 times. So tell us about what you did recently, which is, did you honestly go through trash from World War II? And this is part of the INL's history.
Right. And this is one thing that I personally did not know. Back in the early 1940s, when they were testing weapons for World War II, they needed basically a property, a proving ground, you could say, to test these weapons and to have people live. And so people moved out to Arco, moved out to the desert, and a community was established. There was, you know, baseball teams for kids. There was schools. There was sewing circles that ladies would participate in. And they do weekly movie nights. It was a bustling community in the middle of the desert during the war. And when the war ended, there was no need to test these weapons anymore. And so people moved away. They moved to Idaho Falls, Pocatello, other parts of the country, and they left the landfill of this community, a mile long canal full of trash. And it never, I mean, some of it disintegrated and did whatever, but it's still there. And so we went out there and we went through some of this stuff, and it's fascinating to see, you know, pacifiers from 1945, wow. A mug. We found a mug out there that was in the heap, a hand-painted mug, a bird cage, all sorts of stuff that, you know, is, I don't know, 75 years old, 80 years old, that's still there, little toy trains, things like that, that kind of give you a different look at how people lived back then. Who knows? Maybe they'll be going through our trash in 75 years. I don't know.
Yeah, right? No kidding.
One part of the series. Go ahead.
I was going to say, so Nate, folks can just get onto your website and look for these stories, and you'll just do this throughout throughout the year.
Right. We have a special section on there that's commemorating INL 75th. And I think we've posted 6 or 7 so far, and we'll continue through December.
Well, I just think it's fascinating. So thanks so much for that update. So Melissa, can you tell us about what the Lava Ridge Wind Turbine Project is?
This is a Bureau of Land Management potential project that Magic Valley Energy was hoping to get approval for. The original proposal would have put 400 wind turbines on right by the Minidoka Historical Site. It would have covered almost 10,000 acres. And it received a lot of opposition from everyone to local members of the local community, people who were concerned with preserving the historical site at Minidoka and honoring the internment camp and the horrible things that happened there. Conservation groups had concerns. Our congressional delegation was united in opposition to this. The governor has expressed concern about it. This has been a multi-year conversation, and after receiving public comment, they've scaled back the project proposal. In June, they submitted or they released a new proposal that would reduce the acreage from 9,100 to about 4,500 acres. So about half, and it would lower the number of turbines from 400 to 241. It would cap the maximum height at 660 feet. The project still faces opposition, though. As people point out, that's still taller than the Space Needle in Seattle. This is, if you've been out there, this is a big open space, and there's concern that if you are going to the Minidoka internment camp to learn about what happened there, that if you have this farm of wind turbines, that it minimizes the pain that these survivors, that these families went through. The government continues to work with the tribes, and the federal government continues to work with tribes and Friends of Minidoka. They've said that they've moved it away from the actual camp itself. But there are still concerns. This week, our friends at the Idaho Capital Sun actually have a great rundown of this on their website. But the Attorney General has said that, if this project does get approved, that he does plan to appeal it. That isn't a surprise. Especially after hearing from so many stakeholders that they do oppose this, I'm not at all surprised that the Attorney General has said that they will try to stop this if it does get approved. As Clark Corbin notes in his story, the Committee on Federalism, it's a legislative interim committee, they didn't invite anyone to speak who approves of the project, who thinks that this is a good idea. That doesn't mean that those folks don't exist, but overwhelmingly in Magic Valley, this is something that a lot of folks continue to oppose.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. Kevin, Idaho could start serving more special needs students, but you've written about this, and one of the issues is it would really widen a pretty significant budget gap. Can you talk about that?
Yes, it would. So with the State Board of Education this week, they made a change in the state's special education manual. And it's pretty wonky, so I'll try to make it as simple as possible.
Okay.
This involves special education students who may have dyslexia, or brain injury, other conditions. The way the state had been doing this in the past, they made schools have to do two things, see two things happen before they would qualify a child for special education. That child would have to have a demonstrated learning gap and would not be responding well to intervention from the school. So those two things both would have to happen. Federal government is saying that's too strict. It has to be either or. So basically what the state board did this week was a one-word change in the manual, but that could affect hundreds of kids. It could affect, even more than hundreds of kids. I mean, You know, advocates for students with dyslexia have said that thousands of children were deprived of special education services because of that one word in the manual. So really small change with fairly large impacts. And as you said, we have a big gap in how we're paying for special education. Most of the money comes from the federal government, not all of it. So right now, school districts are probably putting in about $80 million of their own local money into special education. And that gap just continues to grow. I mean, you know, Debbie Critchfield, state superintendent, put the number at $80 million this week. A few months ago, they were talking about it being a $66 million gap. So you can see where the trend is going. This is a problem. And I suspect we'll see a lot of debate, at least some debate in the next legislative session about trying to get more money to target special education students, whether you change the school funding formula. Melissa, you know, we're talking about this for years, changing the school funding formula to try to get more money to schools that serve higher numbers of at-risk students, which could include special education students.
Well, and it's this thing, Kevin, where, I mean, it's necessary, right, to make sure that there is funding for special education students. But then when you think about, oh my gosh, we're talking $80 million, but at the same time, you know, you can't leave these kids behind either. So it's, I mean, that's just a lot to have to, I think, figure out.
Yeah, and not only is it necessary, I mean, that's the obvious thing about this, but there are budget implications to special education funding. Basically, the federal guidelines require that if a school puts X dollars of money into special ed in 1 year, they have to continue at least that funding or grow that funding from year to year. You simply can't cut your budget for special education because, you know, you have to have that floor. The feds require that. So that adds to the budgetary pressure. And that's part of why I think we could see, you know, a good deal of debate maybe this next session about the school funding formula and trying to put more money into special education, because, you know, this is a big problem, and we're talking about a lot of kids. You know, we've got 37,000 kids in the state are in a special education program, and you know doing right by those students, it's not cheap. It's sometimes a lot more expensive than, you know, providing support to students who don't have a disability. So it's a very complicated, very costly issue. And not only do I think we'll see debate about it next session, I hope we do, because this is really important.
Yeah, no, I agreed. Sydney, the villages at Meridian seem to always be adding on. They are expanding again. However, their plans have changed again. So can you talk to us a little bit more about this?
Yeah, so like you said, there's always new things coming to the village. This expansion project that we're talking about here is something that has been talked about since, well, 2013, since the village first opened. And like you said, it's changed a couple of times. The most recent rendition, I guess, of this expansion was going to be 2 6-story buildings connected by a sky bridge, and they were going to have lots of apartments, like 549 apartments on top with a bunch of retail space on bottom. And come to find out, they are pivoting away from that. They're saying, we don't want to do the residential any longer. Market conditions are not good for that. And it's, I mean, we've seen in the past year lots of evidence of that, right? We've had projects for multifamily stall all over the valley, and so this is just another project that was going to be multifamily but is pivoting, and we don't really have the new plans. We just know that the old plans are kind of kaput, and that they're working on new plans. When I spoke with Hugh Crawford earlier this week, he's over the village. He works for CenterCal, which is the village's developer. And he said that likely what we're going to be looking at with this expansion is going to be a single level expansion.
Yeah. Well, I like the quote that you use from him, Sydney, in your article, where you say, he said to you, "We're going to continue to make the Village pretty exciting and dynamic and just continue to keep us relevant and dynamic in the market." And I'm like, okay, well, what does that mean? So I guess we just have to wait and see.
Yeah, we'll wait and see. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see what they come up with for the latest rendition of this storied expansion.
Melissa, you were literally just at the Governor's Firewise news conference before you were so gracious to come on our program today. Can you fill us in on what happened there?
Governor Little joined with some directors from other state agencies, including the Department of Insurance and the Department of Lands, to talk about some 10 recommendations and priorities that they want to tackle, the state wants to tackle to reduce the impacts of wildfire. And it includes, you know, better managing fuels on public lands to reduce fire risk, looking at how to protect consumers of both insurance and public utilities, so all of us, from rate increases that are affected by these catastrophic wildfires. There are 10 recommendations. We're still sorting through them. Those are going to come in the form of, you know, anywhere from looking for grants to legislation to working with the federal government to reduce those fuel loads. But it's so timely today because as we're speaking, crews are fighting a massive and devastating wildfire by Redfish Lake up by Stanley, the small town of Stanley, one of the most iconic towns in and iconic areas in Idaho, is being gutted by this fire. The city of Stanley is in level one, get ready to evacuate status. And there are neighborhoods and areas outside of Stanley that are under an immediate evacuation order and have been, I think, since late yesterday or early this morning. And so this, you know, we here in Boise, we can talk about the air quality and that's so important too, but there are people who are losing their homes. And there's a community that even if it dodges this fire right now, it's going to be affected by the hit to tourism. And it's, you know, I can't, I'm looking at these photos on social media right now as we speak that were just posted moments ago. And it's an apocalyptic sky outside of Stanley right now. That's not an exaggeration. This is a scary, scary time for people in Custer County and south of them in Blaine County. And so this is going to be a constantly changing situation that the state has to address the wildfire risk as our fire season is hotter and it starts earlier and it lasts longer. There's not going to be one instant easy fix, but you know, these recommendations are a start.
So Melissa, I mean, I'm looking at these pictures as well. And I mean, you are not exaggerating. And I mean, it is one of these things that I think we've all known that we live in a place that there is this type of fire risk, but I don't think it hits us until we actually see these pictures. And so many of us have spent time in Stanley, in Grangine. And I mean, this area, and I don't feel like I'm exaggerating when I say this area could be decimated by this fire.
Easily. You know, I've got to put a plug in for, you know, Zeb Palmer on Threads has a fantastic newsletter where he talks about the fire situation statewide, and he really gets into the risk. You know, I mean, we're under a red flag weather warning right now, where we're facing high winds and dry heat. Zeb breaks down a lot of these risks and what we can expect. If you go to Idaho, I think it's idahofire.org, you can subscribe to his newsletter. But he's been watching the Wapiti fire outside of Stanley and Loman for several days now. And it's a scary thing. I know I've covered wildfires before. I moved to more government and legislative reporting, and you don't appreciate how intense some of these wildfires can get until you really experience it. And so, my gosh, hats off to these first responders. They are incredible, doing everything they can to help save this community and all of the structures that are being threatened, not to mention the public lands in the Sawtooths that all of us love.
Mm-hmm. Melissa, do we have any idea at this point when we're, how many structures are being impacted or could be? Because we're talking, as you said, I want people to understand this isn't just like businesses, which is devastating enough, but there are homes. I mean, this, you know, and these are tight-knit communities.
Last I saw, the Wapiti fire is at 36,000 acres and it had 12 structures, but that could be anything from outbuildings to vacation homes. It doesn't mean it's somebody's primary residence. That's not to minimize the destruction here, but I just don't have that information right now. It depends on where it spreads. I think all of us remember the catastrophic fire from Paradise, California a few years ago. That came up in the governor's press conference today about, you know, how that didn't just, that took lives. It decimated a town, but then there were much bigger implications for the rest of the state too, even if they didn't live there and didn't know anyone who lived there, on things like utility prices. So, you know, we can complain about air quality, but this is, and that's important too, right? That we want our kids to be able to breathe clean air, but my gosh, people's homes are at very real risk of burning up in this. And I think all of us fear that this is going to be happening more frequently.
No, I agree. And especially when, you know, you have that go evacuation order, right? For areas like, Custer County and all of that. I mean, and I just think about people having to, you know, evacuate and not knowing if or when they can come back, right, Melissa? I mean, this is what we're seeing right now.
And right now, today we're talking about Stanley. Last month it was, you know, in Nez Perce County, Julietta. There are so many communities that are surrounded by lands that have a lot of fuel load on them. That was a lot of what was addressed at the governor's press conference today. There are some things that are in the government's hands. There are some things that are in landowners' hands, where people can be smart about the landscaping and reducing the fuel load on their own property. It's a multifaceted issue. And again, today it's Stanley. Tomorrow it could be Atlanta. You know, tomorrow
right.
It could be Orofino. And I think that's what all of us have to keep in mind, is that prevention is better than suppression. You know, working ahead to reduce those fuel loads is going to help reduce the intensity of some of these fires and protect some of these communities and homes that are at risk.
And I think about the fact that when we talk about these small communities, a lot of times there's only one way in and one way out. So not only do you have the issue of, you know, folks not being able to maybe get out in time, it is the fact that sometimes it's so difficult. Really appreciate all of the updates on that, Melissa. And folks, I should tell you, we are recording this live in the noon hour today. So if you are listening to this either at 8 p.m. or at 6 p.m. over in Eastern Idaho, or if you are listening to this on a podcast, that information could be changing. So definitely head to idahofire.org, where Melissa told us to go, because you're going to get really good updates there, but of course, other updates as well. A big thank you to our panelists today, Kevin Richards, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Sydney Kidd, reporter with BoiseDev.com, Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, and Nate Eaton, news director at EastIdahoNews.com. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.